is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
You're tuned to AM 580 WILL Urbana. A reminder that a severe thunderstorm watch is in effect for Champaign, Vermilion, Douglas, Edgar, Coles, DeWitt, Piatt, and Moultrie counties in the WILL severe weather coverage area until 7 o'clock this evening. The severe thunderstorm watch, again in effect for Champaign, Vermilion, Douglas, Edgar, Coles, DeWitt, Piatt, and Moultrie counties until 7 o'clock this evening. Stay tuned to AM 580 for the latest weather information and possible warnings. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Today on the program, we'll take a look at what's planned for the site of the destroyed World Trade Center and how we arrived at Freedom Tower. Our guest is architecture critic Philip Noble. Noble is the author of 16 Acres, Architecture and the Outrageous Struggle for the Future of Ground Zero. This outrageous struggle involves quite the cast of characters: developers, politicians, the press, the families of those who lost their lives on September 11th, and of course, the architects. One of the observations Noble makes about architecture is this: architecture is, quote, the most prominent and most culturally engaged of all the arts. It is also the most contingent, an art that is neither high nor low, an art that gets to art only after locking lips with reality, satisfying a client, securing funds and permits and insurance, getting built. Listeners, I welcome your questions and comments for our guest, Philip Noble. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Philip Noble, was trained as an architect. He writes about architecture for the New York Times and Architectural Digest. He also contributes a monthly column, Far Corner, to Metropolis Magazine. His book, 16 Acres, Architecture and the Outrageous Struggle for the Future of Ground Zero, is published by Metropolitan Books, a division of Henry Holt. 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Philip, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon. Let's get to this idea of architecture getting to art only after locking lips with reality. What a great way of putting it. Architecture involves art, science, business. And you say we've got to embrace the complexity. That's what makes architecture great.
Yeah, I mean, the tendency in the profession for decades has been to try to think about architecture, you know, like any of the other arts, as this thing that's primarily about effect and creating meaning through the kind of, you know, piling one symbol on top of another. And, you know, I've always thought that for starters, that's a false pretext, because it ignores all of this complexity that, you know, all of the other wonderful things architecture can do. And also, I've always thought that there's a sort of opportunity in the way that architecture is a sort of bridge between the kind of abstract, you know, world of the arts and everyday life.
Yeah. Yesterday on the program, my guest was Leslie Robertson, a structural engineer who worked on the World Trade Center. And he talked a little bit about this idea of collaboration and the importance of it from his point of view as a structural engineer. You know, he said to me, you know, as an engineer, you can build, but in collaboration with an architect, you may help build a great building. And then he also talked about, you know, the daily stuff. You got to have the money. You got to have the design.
Yeah, and if you ignore that stuff, it comes back to bite you in the end. And we saw a lot of that at Ground Zero. The you know, the kind of corollary to the idea that architecture is just like any art is that it's created in isolation by these great genius figures, you know, in the middle of the night with their sketchbooks and you know, the graphite flying, you know, that's a wonderful myth, but it doesn't, you know, buying into it doesn't get anyone closer to good building.
Yeah. And how blank is the slate?
At Ground Zero? it's not as blank as the development world would like it, and it's you know, it's too haunted for many of the, you know, the victims' families and New Yorkers in general. But there's, you know, the big thing sort of sitting in the middle of the site is the lease that you know, real estate developer Larry Silverstein signed 6 weeks before the attack. That still, you know, no one has risen up to challenge this document, you know, this sort of large version of a standard New York lease. And until somebody does, then, you know, Larry Silverstein has the right to rebuild 10 million square feet of commercial office space on the site. You know, and that certainly increases the complexity of doing anything that would sort of respect the place.
Is it possible to, at this point, to do that?
People should keep in mind, I mean, a lot has been done. You know, my book and several other books' worth of stuff has happened. And it's still a wide open field in a lot of ways because, you know, there was a little blip in the press last week that, you know, everything is essentially on the table still. I mean, you know, there's until in New York, until a building actually occupies the spot, you know, the land is in play, and, you know, anything can happen. Another developer can come in, you know, there could be a change in the political regime, and, you know, if Pataki were to go, then you know, the pressure on Larry Silverstein might increase, and, you know, one thing that happens that's sort of charming is when, you know, and this happened at a site very close to Ground Zero in the last 10 years or so, there was a vacant lot, and a local community board leader sort of took it over for baseball games. And eventually, you know, once it was established as a park, you know, then there was momentum to codify that, and she went through the official process, and now it's a park. So, you know, things are very fluid, and Freedom Tower itself may not be built in the form that it was shown or built at all.
Yeah. What's your assessment of Freedom Tower?
I have a funny perspective on it because I, you know, long before the design for Freedom Tower was revealed, I wrote this passage at the beginning of the book saying that whatever we get there, you know, on the site will be less a reflection of you know, some high ideal and more of a kind of distillation of this mess that begets it, you know, the kind of the clashing of various powers and the public protest and, you know, the architects and their visions, and, you know, all of that goes into the stew, and out the other end comes this object which has in its form, you know, the memory of all of that conflict. And, you know, when I started to see the early designs for Freedom Tower, you know, I didn't think, oh, it's good or it's bad. I said, you know, chapter 11 thanks you, because it was just it was exactly that. It was, you know, nobody could really claim ownership of it, and no one wanted to. And it was a kind of a hybrid of various ideas. I mean, the principal thing that shapes it is two kind of lines in the sky. Larry Silverstein announced very early on, I think in January or February 2002, that he wouldn't build higher than 70 stories. And that was a kind of a calculation he made with his architects about what would be a sort of, you know, a comfortable height that people might actually rent commercial space at Ground Zero.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so that was a given. You know, this 70-story height cap on the site was a given. And you know, previously, you know, George Bush had come down to the site on Friday, September 14th, and acted defiant. And there was you know, a large sort of public, you know, the impression that there was a groundswell of support for defiance at the site. And that, in architectural terms, translates to the world's tallest building. So, you know, you have the second line, which is a height higher than any other building to signal our resolve and the, you know, the aspirations of the great nation. And in total conflict with this much lower, you know, that would have to be at around 1,500 feet or higher. And then you have this Larry Silverstein, you know, the height of the comfort of money. And every design for the tower, you know, Daniel Liebskind's design and the design that Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, you know, this other big, powerful architecture firm, concocted, which became the kind of final design in, you know, in the sort of famous conflict that they had a couple years ago. But everyone was just trying to find a way to bridge between those two lines.
Yeah. And what we get is, I think this is how you describe it early in the going in the book, you know, what we're going to get is going to be big, rude, striving, meager, and right.
Yeah, I mean, there's a way that it's sort of perfect, that it, you know, and there's also a way that it's sort of democratic, you know, although not through any official process, but just through the kind of process of culture as a whole, that this thing does get shaped. You know, Governor Pataki has more power than anyone. Larry Silverstein, you know, via his lease, has significant power. But everyone sort of, you know, deflects and jostles the process to get to this end result of a given building. You know, through, you know, one group that I like a lot is this an advocacy group for rebuilding the towers just as they were, called Team Twin Towers.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they were this wonderful group of sort of like Trekkies, you know, these skyscraper geeks that knew they knew everything about every skyscraper around the world, and they had this very simple position, you know, the towers were knocked down in an act of war and we should rebuild them. And you know, it's completely impossible politically and commercially, but very, you know, very clear morally. And you know, they could never achieve their aims, but they did succeed in keeping this idea of defiant height in front of the press. And you know, in that way, they sort of shaped the final tower.
Hmm. Philip Noble, our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of 16 Acres, Architecture and the Outrageous Struggle for the Future of Ground Zero. Listeners, you can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with our first listener to call in today in Belgium on line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'd like to bring out what seems to be a human trait that you seem to be dealing with and we deal with here in the Midwest on an interesting sort of basis, and I see more and more of it regularly. Whenever a significant loved one seems to pass away in an automobile accident or something, people put crosses along the highway. And there's more and more of them. You see them all along. And seem to have some connection with this 9/11 and rebuilding of the trade towers, that the true desire to have some memorial to a loved one. Now, I understand that it has a personal meaning to those people, but then does it really have a place when it comes to, you know, public property and public domain?
That's an interesting question. There's always been a strong undercurrent of skepticism about the victims' families. I mean, I think partly because, you know, some of the representatives who stepped into the limelight the most were very strident and seemed to be kind of overreaching their grounds. But you know, I mean, there's certainly an argument to be made for the importance of September 11th as a national event, and that there should be some kind of public memorial. And the way the memorial actually is taking shape, the kind of individual expression is of each you know, each of the victims is very subdued. I mean, it may end up just being no more than a, you know, like at the Vietnam Memorial, you know, a list of names. And in the case of Ground Zero, it might even be a list of names in a random order, and, you know, to sort of express the randomness of the day, as the designer has said. But, you know, I think the one thing that's similar between what's gone on and is going on at Ground Zero and these sort of roadside memorials, which, yeah, I mean, that's actually an interesting observation. I have noticed more of those recently, but it's sort of a case of trying to make sacred space out of everyday space, and that's really the big problem at Ground Zero that has never been addressed is you know, how do you make a part of this this site, which is, you know, has trains underneath it and the city around it, and you know, at the end of the day, we'll have a kind of underground shopping concourse, you know, going all shut through, you know, in every corner of the site, and you know, it's one of the most valuable kind of urban commercial properties on the planet right now. You know, how do you kind of eke out a little sacred moment there, especially since there's nothing left of the original place except the bedrock and some foundation walls. You know, so you know, the way the process sort of unfolded with this kind of incredible speed, that question was never addressed.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks for the call. Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon, architecture critic Philip Noble. Before the month of September 2001 was out, the New York Times ran a piece in its magazine, To Rebuild or Not, Architects Respond. What was the range of early responses?
The range of early responses was a lot like the range of eventual responses. You know, there was a faction that said very defiantly, we must rebuild for political reasons, and then there was another sizable group that wanted to rebuild for commercial reasons. You know, the city needs to be the city again. And then there was this sort of, you know, this nothing faction who chimed in very early saying, you know, there should be a park there. And in my favorite among those is Roger Ebert, the film critic who wrote this essay, you know, sort of stepped away from his usual duties in that first week after the attack and wrote this sort of poetic essay about, you know, about sort of the nature of the park you wanted to see there, with benches for old people and ponds where kids could skate, and you know, he wanted to plant corn as a symbol of, you know, I guess the American heartland. But the responses never really developed that much. You know, and I would say that it's a little bit what we were talking about with the last caller, that there simply hasn't been enough time allowed to pass for attitudes about the, you know, the event and the site itself to mature in any responsible way. So it's very much these sort of knee-jerk reactions that rule the day.
Yeah. Well, you quote another critic, Ada Louise Huxtable, as saying, "I frankly wish everyone would just shut up for a while."
Yeah.
why was it so hard to keep from babbling?
Well, I mean, at root, it's this very understandable thing that, you know, everyone was trying to react and everyone was trying to apply their expertise to the site. And in the case of construction workers and you know, medical technicians and cops and firefighters, that was all very clear. You know, you go down there and you help. And then, you know, the kind of white collar economy and you know, sneakers economy in New York and elsewhere, you know, these people didn't know what to do. So everyone started in with their, you know, I saw it particularly within the world of media. You know, everyone started in with their special issues, and you know, they were calling very soon after the attack to, you know, writers. Oh, would you write about this? Would you write about that? And you know, there at one level there's kind of a mercenary quality to it, because it you know, it was sort of trying to stretch yourself into relevance at a time when you know, you may or may not have been actually necessary to you know, the ongoing mm-hmm. cultural moment. But at another level, it's, you know, what are people going to do? And you saw this intensely with architects. You know, and on the one hand, it seems incredibly tasteless that in some cases, you know, the world's leading architects literally picked up their pencils that day and started sketching. And in another way, you know, how else are they going to help?
Yeah. Well, everybody's trying to figure out where we are and how this happened. And
Yeah. And you know, and we're still with the kind of elision between September 11th and the war in Iraq and you know, the ongoing broader war on terrorism, and we're still in this moment enough that it's impossible to step back and you know, be rational.
Yeah. What did you write about at the time?
I had an assignment for Art Forum magazine on something unrelated, and the editor called me up and said, "Where's the text?" You know, a couple days after the attack, and I said, "You know, I can't write about this Brazilian architect I was going to write about right now. You know, let me write something about what happened." And at that point, it was sort of interesting. And this was true, sort of farther afield in the art world as well, that they were actually planning not to do anything, you know, even though their offices are, you know, 20 blocks north of the site and they're all New Yorkers and, you know, dealing with culture kind of through art. And anyway, I talked to the editor and convinced him that you know, they should in fact observe this event. And I ended up writing kind of an essay on the role of the architect down there and what I mean, some of which has been echoed in the book, but mm-hmm. I wrote about what baggage architects would have to leave behind in order to be useful.
Yeah.
Down there.
Yeah. You say the wrong questions were being asked because so many believe that architecture could answer the attack, that it could give, quote, meaning to what had taken place there, and that architecture's best minds, despite such a long, long vacation from pathos, could create such a thing.
Yeah, and it's a little bit of it's an effect of this kind of myth of the genius architect that we were talking about earlier, that, you know, the implanted in the back of the public mind, and then after September 11th, you know, very much in the forefront is this idea that buildings mean something, you know, that they are more than beautiful or not beautiful things that keep the rain out and you know, allow, you know, give shape to cities and house us. And, you know, there is this incredible call, and, you know, you could literally just, you know, hear it on the radio all the time, people saying, you know, everyone's sort of looking to architecture to make them feel better, you know, that something could be built there. And, you know, the architects, for their part, said, you know, started saying yes, yes, yes. You know, yes, of course we can provide this object that, you know, with a, you know, a given shape will somehow, you know, solve this thing that just happened and sort of, you know, make it go away or turn it into the, you know, a sort of a more proper message, mm-hmm. and one that's easier to digest. And a lot of what I do in the early chapters of the book is sort of refute that idea that architecture does have a language that can communicate to people, you know, in that way. I mean, it's just it's making claims for the art that are beyond its ability, and nobody wins in that situation.
Yeah. Well, I guess we're back to, in a sense here, you know, that idea of locking lips with reality.
Right.
In architects, you've got to have confidence and you've got to have ego.
Right. And they sometimes have too much of both. And you know, it in a way seems insulting to, you know, architecture itself, that so many architects are trying to drag it into the art world and leave its complexity aside. And you know, this is the product of a long, you know, of a lot of different things, you know, one of which is the need to, you know, architects have to sell something that's, you know, in most cases the most expensive thing that their client will ever buy sight unseen. So they do have to turn themselves into characters, and they do have to have the ability to sort of razzle dazzle with their drawings and models and whatnot. And sometimes they sort of carry that attitude, you know, they never get out of that character sometimes.
Yeah. That happened here, didn't it? The razzle dazzle thing. That's
At Ground Zero?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one of the more interesting things that happened was the way that architecture was co-opted by the bureaucracy. And, you know, there were two major rounds of planning. You know, the first one in the summer of 2002 was a very staid, very sober attempt to just do space planning at the site, and it didn't serve up the, you know, the razzle dazzle and the symbols and the sort of emotional solution that the public was looking for, and it was just slammed. You know, it was the only moment of unanimity. All parties said this is unacceptable, and then the governor and the bureaucracy that he had put in place to sort of shepherd the process through said, oh, okay, you know, we've tried sobriety. Now we really do have to go and call this sort of other kind of architect, you know, the genius type, and they had a, it became a competition, but initially it was just called the Innovative Design Study, and they brought in Daniel Liebeskind and Norman Foster, and you know, a group of young, very avant-garde architects, and a group, a very funny group of an all-star team of all of the big, kind of old-school New York modernists, and they behaved as architects of this type behave, and they tried to make what they were doing seem more appropriate through elaborate use of specialized images and obfuscatory language. And Daniel Liebskin was the foremost among this group. I mean, he's incredibly eloquent, and he has this wonderful backstory of, you know, born in Poland and immigrated to New York, and, you know, traveled the world and built the Jewish Museum, and he's a very engaging guy. And he, when he appeared with the singular ability to speak about September 11th and architecture in this very joyful way, I think what happened in the bureaucracy is, you know, a light went off and said, you know, we need this guy to in a sense hide behind as we continue this very ugly New York real estate game that they were already sort of knee deep in, but that they had to, you know, continue by to meet the terms of the lease and to meet Governor Pataki's objectives. And they brought in Liebskin, you know, primarily not as a designer, although his design was popular with some people, never as popular with the public, as he said, but they brought him in primarily as a front man, and he spoke magnificently, and then when his figurehead role was no longer needed, he was jettisoned, you know, a year later.
Yeah. And David Childs, how did he come into the...
David Childs is... the way to think about it is Daniel Liebskin was Governor Pataki's architect,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, Pataki very visibly, single-handedly selected him over the wishes of a committee he had put in place to pick the master plan architect for the site. And because Pataki was interested in the kind of symbolic aspects that Liebskin could speak about so effectively, and Silverstein, with totally different needs, you know, his objectives were to build buildings that he could rent and use, and he was already working with SOM, where, you know, Childs is one of the leading partners. And he had been trying, you know, from the beginning to get SOM involved, simply, I think, because he trusted them. You know, they're a huge, very competent, multinational architecture firm that can build anything, and you know, they were his guys. And this situation came to a head in the summer of, you know, about halfway through Liebskin's year of relevance in the process. Silverstein essentially made enough of a stink that the governor had to drop the hammer, and the two architects met in this very long, you know, there was an 8-hour meeting to hash out a one paragraph press release about the nature of their collaboration, and they entered into something that everyone called the forced marriage, where they essentially were trying to design Freedom Tower together in a way that would please both Pataki and Larry Silverstein. And going back to this idea that there are two lines in the sky that Freedom Tower had to hit in order to, you know, to please everybody, their solutions were, you know, not identical sort of stylistically, but conceptually they were, you know, they're doing very similar things. Liebskin's original building was a 70-story office building, very conventional, with this stick on the side that went up to, you know, the height of 1,776 feet, which he contends to this day has some meaning, you know, and would somehow be perceptible to the public standing on the sidewalk down below. I mean, I think it's a very simplistic way to approach architecture, but he had the symbolic element next to the commercial element, and Childs had simply put a kind of open an open air structure, you know, sort of an uninhabited top hamper on top of his 70-story commercial office building that he had to build, and they entered into this gigantic, you know, battle that lasted, you know, 4 or 5 months or through the fall of 2003, just fighting over, you know, essentially should the symbol be on the side or should the symbol be on the top, and then, you know, how high should it be if it goes on the top, and how high could it, you know, can we rent it if it's on the side, and, you know, they no one ever stepped back enough to see, to, you know, of course there were giant egos involved because Liebskin wanted to put his mark on history, and this, and Childs was thinking he could use the job at Ground Zero to sort of reposition himself as a real auteur architect and not a kind of a corporate facilitator.
Hmm.
But I mean that's, you know, all of that story is also sort of imprinted in the final shape of Freedom Tower.
Yeah. The developer, 6 weeks, Larry Silverstein, 6 weeks before 9/11, he leased the right from the Port Authority.
Right.
to profit from the World Trade Center and that site, the buildings, for 99 years. Was there any thought given to could we change that arrangement?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of it was sort of interesting. Larry signs this lease, and which both he and the Port Authority are referring to, at some points on a daily basis, saying, the lease says not only that we can rebuild, but that Larry Silverstein has to rebuild. And because the Port Authority is this funny, bi-state entity that isn't responsible to respond. They're not bound by the Freedom of Information laws, so it's impossible to get information out of them. And Larry wasn't showing anyone the lease, and nobody ever got into the document itself in the fall of 2001, where it could have made a huge difference, and found the relevant language, which is as fuzzy as a lot of legal language. There were other ways to interpret what the lease mandated, and so that was one way that things could have been different. The major effort to get Silverstein off the site, and the Port Authority for that matter, was this wonderful idea that came out of City Hall, which at most points in the process had almost no power.
Mm-hmm.
And one way that Mayor Bloomberg tried to recoup some powers is floating this idea for what everyone came to call the land swap, where the Port Authority leases 5,000 something acres of New York City land under under LaGuardia Airport and JFK, and the idea was to sort of trade the 16 acres of Ground Zero, for this giant acreage out in Queens that nobody cared about, and then the city, the effect would have been that the city would take over, the city planning department, which was sitting on the sidelines, would take over. And absent his landlords, Larry Silverstein would be gone, and he could be bought out somehow and made whole and dismissed. And then it's a whole new ballgame, because there are no commercial pressures on the site to rebuild quickly, so you could sort of rock back and think, what does it mean? How much space really should be devoted to a memorial? How much should be commercial? And it would have been a very different result.
Yeah. When I think of 16 acres... I live in a, middle-sized community.
Yeah.
But when I think of 16 acres, we're surrounded by farmland. 16 acres around us is very little land. But in terms of urban real estate, that's a lot of, it seems to me that's a lot of urban real estate. And to think that this process moved so quickly, I wonder about the idea of urban planning in a city like New York, because here we moved so quickly. 10 months after the attack, at one point in the book, you write, it's all over but the shouting.
Right. The issue of the size of the site is sort of funny. I read in the book that New Yorkers don't know what an acre is. No one has a 1-acre plot that they can reference. So I'm sure people own acreage upstate and out in the country. But most New Yorkers think in terms of square feet. So no one knew how big this place was, and that early on, I think gave and also when you go down there, it's very hard to gauge what it can hold, because there's no ground plan. The site goes down. The east side of the site is two stories below ground, and the west side of the site is this giant 70-story deep pit down to bedrock, and it did lead to a kind of ambiguity about what to do with the place. And you could see this a lot in the kind of folk architectural response to the site. I mean, people this is one of my favorite things that kind of came out of the research, is finding this subculture. I mean, it wasn't hard to find since they were making so much noise, but this great subculture of people all over the world who typically woke up on the morning of September 12th with this eureka moment and thought that they had solved the problem. And then they deluged the politicians with the stuff, and it all ended up kind of in the back room of the bureaucracy being ignored. But you could see in their plans, which were for everything from the world's tallest building to little memorial sculptures, that there was no conception of this place as a place surrounded by you know, city and some kind of urban continuity, and also no conception of the size of it. You know, I mean, I still have difficulty going down there and trying to you know, imagine on the site the things that have been proposed, because it's so sterile and such a desert, mm-hmm. and it's so huge.
Yeah. The idea of the land swap, though,
yeah.
You know, not only would have brought City Hall back into the picture, which we can talk about that in a moment, but it would have provided some time and space for a solid planning process.
Right.
Didn't happen, though.
It would have, I mean... It would have taken it out of the two things that were driving it were you know, the commercial pressure and you know, Larry Silverstein is the first to tell you that developers move, you know, as fast as they possibly can against whatever resistance, you know, to get to be able to start making money on a site no matter what has happened there.
Mm-hmm.
And then the political calendar, and the redevelopment process was shaped by every election that passed in the first couple of years of the process, and you know, the first in the fall of 2001, there people might remember that September 11th itself was the day of the Democratic primary for the mayoral election that was coming up, and in November when the election took place, the governor with Rudy Giuliani tried to everyone expected the Democrat to win and to retain control of the site. Pataki very quickly, it was the Friday before the Tuesday of the election, invented the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation as his bureaucratic means to control the site. And so, you know, that election made its mark. And then the next, you know, the next year was the gubernatorial election, and Pataki, you know, I think of it, it's a little bit like the control rods in a nuclear reactor. I mean, he would act very subtly to speed or slow the reaction of this public process in order to always appear to be actively engaged and looking for a solution, even when there were times when that wasn't the case. So he was always and also very much reaching out to the families, and that had a huge effect that year that he was in full-on campaign mode, because he promised to the families in the summer of 2002 that the footprints would remain sacred, you know, the two squares that where the towers themselves had stood. And that was a wonderful gesture, except there were still people among the families who were campaigning for, you know, a full 16-acre sacred precinct at the site, and threatening to chain themselves to bulldozers. And there was one activist widow who wanted to surround the site with a human chain, and the Pataki's actions that next year had sort of left its mark on this, you know, the eventual shape of the site. And then the presidential election kicked in, and Larry Silverstein, who has a wonderfully loose tongue, especially after the Republicans announced that they were coming to New York for the convention, Silverstein let slip the, I think it was the spring of 2003, the governor was planning to time the cornerstone laying or the groundbreaking of Freedom Tower with the convention, that they were trying to really tie the you know, the histrionics surrounding the convention with some symbolic act at Ground Zero, and that was a huge, you know, kerfuffle in the press, and eventually they ended up laying the cornerstone of Freedom Tower on the 4th of July before the convention in August. But the specter of that political event occurring, you know, 18 months out, completely sped up the clock and turned an already fast paced process into this sort of breakneck experience. And the reason, you know, the one great reason that Daniel Libeskind and David Childs were thrown into the same room so hastily to hash out a solution to Freedom Tower was that Pataki needed, you know, this symbolic image to be associated with the site in time, you know, to cleanse it in a way so that it would be free for polemical use when the Republicans got to town.
Yeah, that's an amazing part of the story. Pataki is just this wonderfully shrewd,
yeah,
character.
If you look at it as if you look at him as purely as a practitioner of you know, sort of black political arts, I mean, he's brilliant.
Yeah. Boy, you know, when I was reading the story, though, I had to think to myself, you know, if this was Chicago, it would have unfolded completely differently.
That's an interesting question. I get all. I don't. The only cities I know well enough to to compare, or, you know, Chicago a little bit and Boston and, you know, maybe Los Angeles. And I can't help but think it would have been different anywhere else and different better anywhere else, and perhaps not quite so vain and petty and greedy. But, I mean, the way I do this sort of end-around reasoning on that in the book at one point, and it's a little bit of a rationalization, but I do think that we don't want to see it, that there's something heartening in how the city, you know, New York City, reacted exactly as one would expect New York to react, mm-hmm. you know, at its worst, you know, and everyone reverted to form and was selfish and greedy and you know, wonderfully colorful and all the other things that, you know, make New York New York. And I read at some point in the book that, you know, we don't want to see the thing that happens to a city that would change its character that way. And I can't imagine, you know, what would have to happen to New York to kind of strip it of all of those attitudes.
Yeah. Well, Chicago is a city of cloud. I mean, I think a lot of the same things would happen, you know. I mean, those lips of, you know, lacking lips of reality, again, yeah. You know, that idea. But I think that here in the state of Illinois, it would be the mayor of Chicago who would reign supreme.
That was a funny thing. I mean, there's a history of governors of New York shaping New York City. I mean, people in New York forget that there is a governor. You know, it feels very, you know, city-state. But the governors of the state have always had a role in the redevelopment, but never has anyone written off the opposition to the degree that Pataki did. And literally, there was no Democratic representation in the process at all. And the Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver, whose district encompasses Ground Zero, was just whited out everywhere. I mean, he piped up last week to say, the progress has stalled on the site and let's get going. And I think that was the first time I'd seen him make a peep about Ground Zero in years. And so that was you know, more of Pataki's genius.
Yeah. We're going to have to wrap up here presently, Philip. And before we go, though, I want to get back to the idea of architecture and what it can do and what we ask it to do.
Right.
You know, we want our buildings to provide meaning, and, you know, that's one of the big questions here in 16 Acres, your book. Buildings, you note in the book, a couple of different places, they can speak, they can sing. You say great architecture sings, but it does so wordlessly, not so much by telling us this or that, than by triggering some nameless emotion, and the more nameless, the better.
Yeah, it's a very, very, very difficult thing to make a pile of inert material do anything. And my feeling is that most architects should strive for beauty and to let the building acquire meaning sort of the old-fashioned way through the passage of time. And what happened at Ground Zero is everyone needed instant meaning, so it became almost a question of allegory or you know, very simple symbolic cues like Liebskind 700, you know, 1776 height on Freedom Tower.
Yeah.
There isn't a way for architecture to step up and solve that problem right now.
Yeah. Well, in other arts, you know, they say don't start off trying to communicate a message.
Right.
You know, in literature or drama.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, that architects could do well to heed that advice.
Yeah. Anything else you'd like to say here before we have to say goodbye?
No, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Lots of really interesting ideas in the book about architecture, and a wonderful story with quite the cast of characters. Our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine has been Philip Noble. Philip, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Philip Noble is the author of 16 Acres, Architecture and the Outrageous Struggle for the Future of Ground Zero. The book is published by Metropolitan Books, a division of Henry Holt. It's 10 minutes before 2 o'clock, and in just a moment here, we're going to go to Todd Gleason to get settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade. But let me remind you that a severe thunderstorm watch is in effect for Champaign, Vermilion, Douglas, Edgar, Coles, DeWitt, Piatt, and Moultrie counties in the WILL severe weather coverage area until 7 o'clock this evening.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
Now let's find out what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Day to day at the board, and the markets showed it by not really moving too much. The beans finished the day nearly unchanged, although the deferreds were down about 4 cents in the SEPs and the Novembers, but the nearby is unchanged for the day. Corn futures up a penny to up a quarter, depending on where you were in the futures market and which month. And in the wheat futures were down 2.5 cents, but trade was, as Dave Dickey tells me as he was watching it all day, fairly lackluster for a good portion of the day. May futures in the wheat pit for the soft red winter wheat, a high today of 315.5, a low at 309.5, and a settlement price at $3.11. They were down 2.5 cents today. July futures 324.5, the high, the low at 318.75, settled at 321.25, down 2.25, and the September futures 332, the high, the low at 326.25, settled 328.5, they were off a penny, and the December futures 342, the high, the low at 336.25, settled 337.75, down 1.75 for the day. March futures in the wheat pit 346, the high, the low at 343.5, a settlement price at 345, they were down a penny and a half. Now, while it did not show up in the official statements from USDA's crop progress report yesterday, corn planting did manage to take place across a portion of the Midwest. Those numbers were not in the official national numbers, but the statisticians in Illinois, Indiana, and Iowa have contacted us, gave us some figures. Pretty interesting. About 2% of the crop in Indiana has been put in the ground. Nothing or negligible to speak of in Iowa. And Brad Schwab over at Illinois says we're off to a heck of a start in the state of Illinois. I think he said last year they were at 5%. Is that correct? And then this year they're at 14% planted in the state of Illinois. So farmers in somewhere in the state of Illinois have been really rolling. That's not been the case here in the east central part of the state, where they've been waiting for this rainfall that actually came last night. Put the planters to the sideline. Didn't make too much difference to the folks in Chicago. They managed to push the corn price a penny higher today, and with a settlement price at 206.75 in the May, and a high of 207, a low at 205. Once again, that May corn contract at 206.75 settlement price, they were up one for the day. July futures at 215.5 high, low at 213.25, settled at 215.25, up 1.25. And the September futures in the corn pit, 222.5 the high, the low at 220.75, settled 222.25, up one for the day. Now your new crop, the crop being put in the ground now, December futures, 232.25 the high, the low at 230. Settled 231 in the corn pit, up a quarter for the December contract. March futures, 239 the high, low at 237.25. Settlement price there at $2.38 a bushel, and they were up a quarter for the day. May futures, 242.75 the high, the low at 241.5, and a settlement price at 242.5. They were up a half. We'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana, about what happened at the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. That coming up during the closing market report starts in just a little more than 10 minutes, about 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time today. Oats, May futures, 116.25 the high, the low at 158.5. Settlement price there, $1.59. They were up one. July down a quarter today. 158 the high, the low at 156. Settlement price at 156.75. May soybeans, $6.22 the high for the day. The low at 613.5. That nearby May contract settled at 617.5. They were 3/4 higher. July futures, 628 the high. That's 628. The low at 619.5. Settled at 624.5. And they were unchanged. August futures, 627 the high, the low at 618. Settlement price at 622.5, down a quarter. And the September futures in the bean pit, 620.5 the high, the low at 611. Settled 613.25. They were down 4.25 for the day. November futures off 4.25 as well. Had a high today of $6.16, a low at 605.5. And they finished the day at 6.08 1/4 down 4 1/4 for the November beans. January futures next year, 6.18 the high, the low at 6.09. Settlement price at $6.10 a bushel, down 5.5 for the January soybeans. Now the products, bean meal, May contract, 188.80 the high, the low at 185.50. Settled 187.30, they were off 20. And July futures, 189.40 the high, the low at 186.50, settled 187.90, and they were down 30 for the day. May bean oil, 22.73 on the high, the low at 22.47, settled 22.40, up 16. And the July oil, 22.89 the high, the low at 22.62, settlement price at 22.61, up 14 for the day. Just a quick reminder, make sure you stay with us for the closing market report today. And on Thursday, thanks to Celeste Quinn and company in the Afternoon Magazine, we'll go all the way through the 3 o'clock hour when we'll take up your questions on the World Trade Organization. That's a call-in program. Starts about 20 after the hour of 2 o'clock during the closing market report. Thanks to Celeste Quinn and company for freeing up some time in April, every Thursday in April and the first two Thursdays in May, to allow us to talk about agricultural policy. Speaking of Celeste, here she is with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange. Celeste?
Okay, thank you, Todd. Higher day today for livestock contracts in feeder cattle and live cattle. Lower day today for lean hogs and May bellies. April feeder cattle, 109.25, the high, the low, 108.65, that's the low. The settlement, 109.17.5, that up 70. May, 106.30, the high, 105.15, the low. The settlement, 106.15, that up 117.5. August feeders, 108.20, the high, 107.02.5, the low. The settlement, 108.05, that up 117.5. April live cattle, 89.15, the high, 88.17.5, the low, 89.02.5, the settlement, that up $1. June live cattle, 84.87.5, the high, the low, 83.72.5, the settlement, 84.67.5, that up $1. April lean hog, 69.72.5, the high, the low, 69.10, the settlement, 69.70, up 72.5. May, 76.87.5, the high, the low, 75.65, the settlement, 76.07.5, that down 50. June lean hog, 78.40, the high, 77.15, the low, the settlement, 77.65, down 27.5. July, 78.82.5, the high, the low, 77.55, finishing at 78.42.5, down 7.5. May bellies, 92.55, the high, 91.05, the low, 91.25, the settlement, that down 62.5. The Dow is up 52 points at 10,500. The S&P 500, 6 higher at 1,187.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
This is WILL Urbana, and some new weather information that I will pass along to you now. Some of these counties that I'm going to mention are in our severe weather coverage area. Others are outside of the coverage area. So rather than make you hang in there and wait till we get it all sorted out, let's just bring you all the information here. This is a special weather statement. Funnel clouds have been sighted over parts of central Illinois this afternoon, and funnel clouds will